Welcome to another exciting episode of Not in a Creepy Way, the podcast where the Brothers Anderson will dig deep into the movies. The Brothers Anderson are... This is Eric.
It is better to be truthful and good than to not.
This is Brother Jay.
You ask me if I have a God complex? Let me tell you something. I am God.
This is Drew.
Why? If it ain't a clown. You know, I never found clowns that funny myself.
And they're sometimes joined by guests like...
This is Travis.
I had to stop her from screaming.
And Diane.
If you men only knew.
So sit back, close your eyes, and let us take you away. Unless you're driving, in which case keep your eyes open and watch the road and, you know, anyway. Welcome. This is Eric.
This is Drew.
And tonight we're going to talk about the 2006 Michael Mann film Miami Vice, starring Jamie Foxx and Colin Farrell.
Yeah. So let me ask you this before we get started, as we get started. Did you have any kind of relationship with the TV show when it was on there?
I'm going to guess the answer to that is not enough. Because, I mean, I remember watching it here and there, but I think when it was on, I was probably working, you know, during the days that it was on at night. So, I mean, I think I probably saw the G. Gordon Liddy episodes, but I think I was probably literally like at work when it was on.
Yeah, I think I was 9 or 10 when it started. So I don't remember. I don't think I ever watched it. Regularly, I might have caught an episode here or there, but my memory of it was of a different show than it actually is. So when I saw this movie in the theater, Miami Vice, and I had no concept of what the television show really was when I saw the movie the first time. But a year or so ago, when I was recovering from my back surgery, didn't have much else to do. I was catching up on old TV shows. And I wanted to revisit Miami Vice because I am a Michael Mann fan. And, I found that the TV show was a lot darker and grittier than I had anticipated.
Really?
Yeah, my memory was that it was a kind of a goofy show with, you know, he lived on a boat and had a pet crocodile. And had snappy banter with his partner, but that's not really what the show is. The show's pretty dark. You know, it has kind of the 80s treatment where it's melodrama and kind of slapsticky sometimes, but at least the episodes of the first season that I'd gotten through were pretty dark, and the pilot itself was especially dark. And I think that really helped my viewing of this movie on the second go around, but we can get into that.
Yeah. yeah. Let's just say that this was, I remember watching this originally on, I didn't see it in the theater. I watched it on video of some kind. And I think it was just pretty much forgettable. And that's kind of how I felt about watching it this week too. Except that I was a little more angry about this time.
Because time is more precious now?
Well, not that. But I think I expected more. And we'll get into it, but I think it really played to some of the weaknesses of what he was trying to do.
Did you like this movie?
No.
I did not like it the first time I watched it. But I have to say, I really liked it this go around.
Well, you're going to have to tell me why, because I have some very serious criticisms of this movie.
Let me list off some reasons why I hated it the first time I watched it.
Okay.
Colin Farrell's accent.
Yes.
I hated that. Gong Li acting in English is really rough.
Yes.
There's no reason that the two characters who do fall in love, and the movie is a shark. It has to keep moving forward or it dies.
Well, I found it incredibly slow and about a half an hour too long. And I didn't find any chemistry at all between Jamie Foxx and Colin Farrell. I didn't think there was adequate time. I think it relied on you remembering the characters from the TV show. And because the whole movie starts out in kind of the middle of the story. Like, it doesn't start out like introducing the characters like you would in a traditional movie. It kind of starts out in like without much preamble. And, you know, Jamie Foxx and Colin Farrell as Crockett and Tubbs, they're partners and they're, you know, they'll never let each other down or whatever. But there's no reason why this happened. You're never told or shown what this bond is all about.
Yeah, I disagree with that.
Okay. Well,
I think you are shown through the course of the movie. You're shown.
Well, maybe through the course of the movie, but yeah. In the beginning, you're certainly not shown.
Oh, it's definitely not in the beginning. But, you know, thinking back, that's kind of a Michael Mann thing, right? I mean, if you think back to Heat,
well,
they don't spend any time setting up the relationships. They just go, and through the course of the movie, you come to understand the relationships. And Heat had a little bit of exposition about the Al Pacino character, and there's really none of that here in this movie. But upon thinking about it more, yeah, it's sort of Michael Mann on 11 in this movie.
Yeah. This actually watching it made me worried about watching Heat again. I'm wondering if I'm going to find Heat to be really slow, because I remember all the big action set pieces in Heat, but I'm starting to remember the big long periods in between action sequences.
I really enjoyed that about this movie this time around.
Okay, well, you'll have to tell me about it, because I've got problems. The first thing really is Colin Farrell's accent is horrible. It's like he went to the Liam Neeson School of American Accents. And I wish I could do it. Comedian Jordan Morris from Jordan Jesse Go does the best version of this, specifically Liam Neeson, but where non-Americans put on the generic American accent, and it's a lot of, right, yeah, yeah, okay, that kind of thing.
Yeah, and in some parts, I'm guessing in chronological order how they filmed it, he's got he's laying on a thicker like southern, almost hillbilly accent.
Oh, he is, and he also is trying to do that Don Johnson gravelly voice thing, and it's just coming out as trying to cover his accent.
This is ASAC, John Fujima.
Detective Crockett.
What's your Miami Dade badge number, date of birth?
447 Charlie 1292.
447 Charlie 1292.
Miami Dade meeting.
Okay, so.
One of your deals may be going bad. Confidential informant, we cut loose, you guys. See, his name is Alonzo Stevens. He called us. We haven't spoken to him in 6 months.
Now, how do I discuss this over an open phone line?
How the hell do I know? We got the phone call from Alonzo on an open line. That is the hand we have been dealt at 11:47 o'clock on Saturday night.
But it took me until almost the end of the movie to figure out what I didn't like about his look. Because he had the Don Johnson clothes right, but the mustache and the hair and stuff to me didn't work at all. And you know why? Because I figured out, maybe 7/8 into the movie, you could have replaced him with Guy Fieri.
Maybe the child of Guy Fieri and John Voight from Heat.
Oh, or Arnold Schwarzenegger from Conan the Barbarian. Or maybe Alexander Goodenough for the hair. I don't know. I just, crazy. It was just crazy. And Jamie Foxx was just Jamie Foxx. I mean, luckily they didn't put him in that ridiculous afro, sort of a almost like a perm that I can't remember the actor's name who played Tubbs in the TV show.
Philip Michael Thomas.
Ah, nice. What has he done since? Any idea?
He was a voice actor on Grand Theft Auto Miami.
Oh, good for him.
Is that what it's called, Miami?
I don't know. I haven't. The last Grand Theft Auto game I played was still Grand Theft Auto 2, the top-down game where you could go to England and the controls were all funkified. Anyway, it was crazy.
Vice City. Grand Theft Auto Vice City. One of my favorites.
I never played those games. I've heard good things, but, you know, really pretty much Fallout was like my niche when I had that time, which will never come back, probably.
I'll give it 15 years.
Yeah, there you go. And then I'll put on my Oculus Rift or whatever kind of Minority Report hardware they have for video games at that time.
Mm-hmm. And your family members will all say, remember Eric?
Exactly. Yeah. He used to do a podcast, but now he just spends all night playing video games. So here's a couple of little tidbits that I found interesting. So just before they started filming, Jamie Foxx won the Oscar for Ray. And because of this, he demanded a raise because his salary was originally lower than Colin Farrell's. So they gave it to him and cut Colin Farrell's salary.
That's funny, since Colin Farrell definitely has the bigger part.
Oh, totally. Yeah, he's the whole reason for the season. And in the European advertising, Colin Farrell gets top billing, but in the American advertising, Jamie Foxx got top billing.
That sounds very Hollywood.
When they were filming in the Dominican Republic in October 2005, I guess the public didn't respond in the most peaceful way to their filming. So there was a lot of what's described as raucous behavior and then a shooting where somebody got hurt. So Jamie Foxx left the country and refused to work outside of the U.S. So Michael Mann had to change the ending, which was supposed to be filmed in Paraguay.
Interesting. I wonder what part of the ending that would have been.
Yeah, I don't know. Maybe they go after Montoya.
Oh, that would have been disappointing. I really like the way it ended.
Yeah. Well, yeah. Anyway. By the way, I did like parts of this movie. They just were few and far between. It starts out with them, Crockett and Tubbs, working in an undercover prostitution sting in a nightclub. And they're there to arrest a pimp. And that's how we meet James Sonny Crockett, Colin Farrell, and Ricardo Rico Tubbs, Jamie Foxx. And during the operation, they receive this frantic phone call from a confidential informant, Alonzo Stevens, played by John Hawks from Eastbound and Down. And Stevens...
And Deadwood.
Oh, and Deadwood. Okay. I haven't seen Deadwood, but I have the first two seasons. How many seasons of Deadwood were there?
Three.
Oh, okay. Well, I've got two to work on. So Stevens says he's got to leave town. And he just wants to thank them and let them know that he never gave them up. So this freaks Crockett out, because Crockett was the one that gets the phone call. So he and Rico go onto a roof and talk about how they need to kind of basically bail from the operation they're on now and go after Stevens and find out what's going on. So they find out that he was working as an informant for the FBI, but had been compromised. And so they contact the FBI Special Agent in Charge, John Fujima, played by Ciaran Hinds from Munich and Road to Perdition. And try to warn him.
In Game of Thrones.
Oh, in Game of Thrones, okay. And try to warn him about Steven's safety. So they end up tracking him down through a vehicle transponder and aerial surveillance. The tech in this movie actually is a big star. The tech and the vehicles are, I think, on the same level of star as the human actors for the most part. So they go after Steven's Bentley in Crockett and Tubbs' Ferrari, and end up stopping him along I-95. And he reveals that a Colombian cartel had become aware that the Russian undercovers were working with the FBI, and they had threatened to murder his wife or girlfriend Send him pictures of her wearing this C4 necklace bomb if he didn't confess. So Rico...
The Aryan Brotherhood has his lady, right?
Yes. So Rico calls or makes a phone call, or they send officers to Leonetta's house and find that she is already dead so that Alonzo doesn't have to go home. And it's kind of a nice scene where he tells him, you know, hey, there's, you know, you don't need to go home. And so Stevens is so distraught that he steps in front of an oncoming semi-truck and kills himself, which is a nice scene. It's nice and powerful.
One of the reasons that I really enjoyed this movie this time around was I was sort of familiar with the plot. The first time I watched it in the theater, I had no idea what was going on, and everything moves so fast. Anytime anything action-y or plotty happened, I had a really hard time following what was going on. But this time around, I don't know if I was just in a better headspace or I remembered enough from my first viewing to go with it. I just kind of went along for the ride and was able to really, really just enjoy the mood of it. And because I think this movie is really mostly all about mood. Like 90% of the movie takes place in the evening, and it's shot really beautifully for being in the dark most of the time. I don't know if it's like digital effects that they do with the night sky, but you know, it's lit really interestingly. You can see kind of the beautiful night clouds, and most of the locations are interesting. Even this scene, it takes place on a bridge, right?
Yes.
And, it's just an interesting setting, and it's, you know, being on a bridge in that kind of enclosed space where you have the fall on one side and the traffic on another. It's claustrophobic to begin with. And then it's even more tense because this guy is clearly not in a good headspace and he's receiving bad news. So I really just enjoyed the mood that the movie started out with. It definitely trusted its audience to follow along without a lot of exposition, which I do appreciate.
Well, I'm going to suggest, first of all, you're absolutely right. It really is pretty. There are some very pretty scenes, but it's not continuously pretty because a lot of what's shot is shot on digital, and there's these crazy extreme close-ups, and the camera's moving around a lot during some scenes. And yet the scenes with the vehicles, everything that involved a vehicle was beautiful. I mean, the boats, like they fetishized the boats and the cars and the plane and everything. But when you got to just people and action scenes, it was fairly tight and claustrophobic feeling, which for some things added an element that I liked. And in other things, it was like, oh, stop, just stop. I like things like they captured I think it was the Ferrari that has that had that like blue flame thing come out of the tailpipe, which I guess is the thing that Ferrari engine actually does. And that just looked...
Does it really?
Yeah.
The fuel is so rich that it burns blue?
Yeah. Yeah, like it'll actually come out the tailpipe with the blue flame when it does something, when it's like high RPMs or something. So,
nice.
Yeah, so it's really nice. I mean, and later we have a scene of a plane that's like this twin prop push-pull kind of plane that you get some really gorgeous shots of that. And then, of course, the boat scenes, I guess it's the whole thing started out with a go-fast boat race, which, well, I won't even worry about the plot elements of that, but because you would think it would be fairly easy to find out who owns a boat in Miami, especially $500,000 boat. Because it wasn't like it was an undercover boat. It had their race team logo on it. So anyway, so En route to the murder scene, Sonny and Rico receive a call from Lieutenant Castillo, who originally was Edward James Olmos, right? Or am I thinking...
Is that really the same character? Is that Castillo?
Uh-huh. Yep.
Yeah, that was Edward James Olmos.
Yep. And he's played by Barry Shabaka Henley from Collateral. He was a friendly face to see.
Mm-hmm.
And he plays a good lieutenant, actually. He's got the face for it.
He does.
So the lieutenant tells them to stay away from the murder scene, and he meets them downtown, where they're introduced in person to Special Agent in Charge Fujima. And I guess he's heading a task force, interagency, FBI, DEA, ICE. And Crockett and Tubbs berate the FBI agent for errors and ask why the Metro-Dade Police Department wasn't involved or Miami PD wasn't involved. And Fujima says that the Colombian group is highly sophisticated and run by a guy named Jose Hierro, who's played by John Ortiz of Silver Linings Playbook and Fast and Furious 6, who is thought to be the cartel's leader. So, they join the task force, and the lieutenant has to make sure that they are deputized into the task force itself as federal agents.
Oh, they don't join the task force, right? They are the new task force. They and their Miami Vice crew.
Yes, because they know more than the FBI.
And they're not compromised.
Yes, and the FBI obviously is compromised, as we find out from this whole Stevens incident. And of course, you know, they like Stevens, and the fact that he's dead and his girlfriend is dead, that doesn't play well with them. So,
right.
They begin to look into these go-fast boats coming from the Caribbean, delivering narcotics from the Colombians, and they use their contacts to set up this meet and greet with the cartel.
Well, after they steal a load, right?
Yes. Yeah, they go in and steal a load so that it requires the cartel to find another transportation. They farm out their transportation. Everything else is in-house. So they basically organize a raid to get rid of their current transportation so they can go in and offer their services. So they are posing as drug smugglers, and they meet with Hierro, what, in Haiti?
That sounds right. And they are set up with fake identities and fake backstories so that if their backgrounds are checked out, they'll pass inspection as career criminals.
Yeah, even deep inspection, because it's aliases on top of aliases on top of aliases. So they should be absolutely safe. So they have this tense meeting with Hierro, who is, his character is a jerk. He's played very well.
I loved him. He was, John Ortiz. I really recognize him most from a really small movie called John Goes Boating. I don't know if you ever saw it.
I've never seen it. John Goes Boating?
It was a Philip Seymour Hoffman movie. It was really small. And in that movie, John Ortiz kind of plays this like really gentle kind of sad sack kind of character. So it took me a while to recognize it, that this dude, Hierro, who plays the entire movie with these intense, crazy eyes, was the same actor. So I thought he did a great job.
Oh yeah, he was fun. Yeah, I don't have a problem with most of the acting in this movie, actually. I just have a problem with the pace. So we have this tension building, and there's a scene where Crockett pulls out a hand grenade to basically deflect all of the handguns that are being pointed at him and machine guns. They've established that everybody in the room's a badass. So they pass the screening and are introduced to the real kingpin, Archangel De Jesus Montoya, played by Luis Tosar, who I don't know really anything about except he's done a bunch of Spanish movies, but
With his bushy beard, he has like the most menacing male pattern baldness I can remember in a movie.
Oh, and he's got the dead eyes and the combination with that and Michael Caine's lack of blinking that allows him to be a really effective bad guy. Like, he never blinks ever. So it's perfect. Yeah, yeah. And he's got that beard thing going with him. Actually, I thought a lot of comedian Brody Stevens, who could also play a really bad guy, I think.
Maybe.
Or maybe kind of a Renfield.
Yeah, this dude Montoya could be Brody Stevens, like a cooler older brother.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, the football playing brother instead of the baseball playing Stevens.
Right.
Yeah. Anyway, so they meet with Montoya, and Montoya sends them away with kind words to their families, and Tubbs calls his girlfriend Trudy, Naomi Harris, Skyfall, 28 Days Later, and a couple of the Pirates of the Caribbean movies. He calls her concerned. By the way, she's also a member of their team, and we've already seen like the love scene between them earlier. But he calls her, and she's just gotten this wonderful bouquet of flowers, she thought, from him. But no, they turn out to be from Montoya.
Probably more accurately, from Euro.
Oh, probably. Yeah, because Euro is the computer guy.
Yeah, it turns out Euro's not the head of the cartel. He is the cartel's counterintelligence specialist. His whole job is to ferret out the truth and figure out if anybody's working for the authorities.
So right there, Tubbs knows this is bad. And he and Trudy have what seems to me like an endless conversation about how she's in danger, but she's also professional, so he needs to worry about himself. She'll take care of herself. Blah, 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 blah. Gigantic snooze fest.
That's funny. It didn't feel that long to me, which reminds me of the 9-minute Jerry Springer scene from Domino, which I went back and looked at and realized it was only like 2 minutes and 47 seconds.
Ah, okay. Well, I guess touche then. So Crockett and Montoya's financial advisor, Isabella, played by Lee Gong from Hannibal Rising, they began a secret romance.
She was in a movie called Curse of the Golden Flower. Have you seen that one?
I have not.
So that's actually a Chinese language movie, and it is great. And she is great in it. She gives a devastating performance in that movie.
Well, she actually...
So I know she's a much better actress in her native language than she seems in this movie.
Well, IMDb credits her with a bunch of award nominations and 2 award wins, so I had to find those out. She won 2 different awards for bad acting in this movie, which I think is a little unfair, because she didn't do that bad a job. She was just a little flat.
Yeah, it really is. And she has some moments, you know, mostly when she's not speaking, but she has some good emoting.
Yes. But they end up going to Cuba for mojitos. And you learn a little bit about her and her family and blah, 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 blah. There's this building sense of dread because, of course, it's a forbidden romance. Like, they, you know, Crockett and...
That happens after their first smuggling run, right?
Does it?
Yeah, I'm pretty sure it does.
Yes, you're right. You're right. I'm sorry. Yeah, they do the first smuggling run where we get to see the long shots of the airplane, which, you know, I thought, the details tell you what kind of airplane it is, but I don't particularly care. I mean, it's pretty and all, but I just thought it was a lot of wasted time. Like, there is no need.
Cool.
Well, there is no need to establish that they're flying under the radar or whatever. We can just take it at their word that they do a good job, right?
You could.
At least I thought so.
I didn't mind it. I thought it was pretty.
It was pretty. Yep. Yeah, at least that is actually filmed on film, I believe. So that's nice. And there is a building sense of dread because the whole Isabella Crockett forbidden romance thing. And then,
oh, I forgot during the Haitian standoff with the grenade in the room with everybody with the guns, where each side proved that they were both badasses. I loved Euro's whiskey glass at the end. Did you notice it?
I did not.
It was a little short glass that had like the half circle nubs on the bottom that it rested on.
Yes.
Yeah. So I think Grandpa Sherwood had like that set of glasses.
Oh.
I've always dug those glasses.
It's probably an attainable goal.
Probably. I don't love them enough to like go out glass shopping.
Well,
but if I ever happened to see the set, I would totally buy it.
Okay. Well, we know what to put on your holiday receiving list.
There you go.
Yeah. Or if you guys,
if any listener wants to send a gift to Not in a Creepy Way.
Oh yeah, just
some whiskey glasses.
Yeah, just drop us a line at notinacreepyway.com. Gifts at notinacreepyway.com. And we'll send you the address, and you'll get a good shout-out. Also, you can send cash through the mail, too. Yeah, so to me, I constantly wanted to skip parts of this movie. And it may have been a time and a place thing for me, but it was like, oh, come on, we need to get more action. So, during the course of their investigation, Crockett and Tubbs learn that the cartel is using the Aryan Brotherhood to distribute drugs and supplying them with state-of-the-art weaponry, which is what they use to kill the Russian undercovers.
Yeah, they had some pretty devastating looking like 50 caliber sniper rifles.
Oh yeah. Yeah.
That actually like blew body parts off when they hit.
Oh yeah, it was actually all the scenes of like the gun battles in this movie are good. And everybody pretty much dies really nicely in this movie. Like, I'm trying to think of a scene where somebody is killed that it doesn't actually come off as really, really nicely done. Of course, what happens, but Trudy is kidnapped by the Aryan Brotherhood. This is by order of Euro, who never trusted Crockett and Tubbs. So, the Aryan Brotherhood demand that Crockett and Tubbs, by the way, they're now doing this second, much bigger load that they're going in by boat instead of plane. And while en route, while they're actually picking up the drugs and getting ready to deliver them by boat, that's when they get the call from the Aryan Brotherhood that they've got Trudy and that they're going to be delivering the cargo directly to the Aryan Brotherhood.
Which is what they wanted and what they didn't get with the first shipment. The first shipment came in, and for whatever reason, that got sent directly to the cartel's people up north. So it bypassed the Miami connection, which is one of the reasons they wanted to do another run, because they wanted to get at the Miami guys.
So this is where the plot problem I have isn't a huge deal, but they end up jumping off of the boats, Crockett and Stubbs do, so they could go to the raid on this trailer park mobile home instead of sending, I don't know, the SWAT guys or something. But that's okay, because they leave Herc and Gina Calabrese, Elizabeth Rodriguez from Orange is the New Black. I'm sorry. She goes with Crockett and Tubbs, and Herc from The Wire and another member of their team take the boats to meet with the Aryan Brotherhood.
That's Mr. Jennifer Aniston.
Is Mr. Jennifer Aniston is who?
The other guy.
Oh, okay. What's the other guy's name? I have it written somewhere. Maybe I don't.
It doesn't matter.
He has a nice scene at the end, though. But when...
he was also the lead in the HBO series The Leftovers.
I don't know anything about The Leftovers.
No, it's a show about what the people left behind on Earth after the rapture have to deal with.
Well, fun. So Crockett and Tubbs and Gina, along with the lieutenant, go after this mobile home, and they're going to do a raid to rescue Trudy. And I liked every part of the scene.
Yeah, I liked the scene going from the boat to the trailer park, because that is a callback to the iconic In the Air Tonight scene from the pilot of the TV show.
Oh my God. Except, okay, I've got a question. Why didn't they pay the fucking money for the Phil Collins version of the song? Were they trying to be edgy because they used Moby music in the first part of it? So they used this, was it like, I don't even know what the band's name is, Nonpoint or something?
Oh, they definitely were trying to be edgy. I mean, that's the whole thing. This was an edgier version of Crockett and Tubbs. This was not it wasn't even the characters from the television show. It was just the feel.
But In the Air Tonight is already like a haunting song with like rough edges to it. The version they used in this movie was not rougher edged. It was softer.
Yeah. But after what they did on the television show, you cannot use the same song. Even if you're paying homage to that scene, you can't.
Okay. All right. Well, I'll take your word for it. They should have used a different song then. I don't know. I like the familiarity of it, but I didn't like the execution of it. And this.
Oh, I did. I loved it.
Well, this, I got into a little YouTube hole. We'll just cav off here for just a second. In preparing for next week's episode, we're doing the music episode of, Thin Lizzy's Jailbreak.
I can't wait.
Oh, me too. I have so much to talk about. But so I ended up looking for, Jason introduced me to EDM DJ, a breakbeat electronica artist called BT. His real name is Brian Transo, and the song Never Gonna Come Back Down, which M. Doty from Soul Coughing does the vocals on. And he name checks a couple of other DJs.
I'm just gonna talk this one. I'm just gonna say this to the people, not so much the people in the audience, the people sitting in my mind. ¿Dónde está los digits do DJ rap?
And so I wanted to go down a hole to find what would be a similar song, because some of the other stuff that BT does not have the same like up-tempo rocking quality that Never Gonna Come Back Down has. Yeah, I don't know if you're familiar with this song, but I love this song. In fact, there's a remix of the song that I like even better, and I haven't found anything that even comes close. I even had to figure out, okay, what is this actually called? And it's like, it's breakbeat, but it's more of a pop version of breakbeat. So I'm looking up other breakbeat remixes and other remixes of other songs in the breakbeat style. Which is to say, if they had just breakbeated it up with In the Air Tonight, like the song Connected, who does that song? There's the movie Blow, but who the...
We are here to save the Earth. Like a boom to the wisest non-bidding on.
Chemical Brothers?
I don't think so. I know the song you're talking about.
Yeah. Yeah, that's kind of, you know, it's not quite as rocking, but it's definitely got kind of a grungy groove to it. But In the Air Tonight, when it's not haunting and eerie, is just a pop song. Might as well have been Air Supply. It could have been Leo Sayer.
So funny. I love this scene so much. This was the moment where I thought to myself, fuck yeah, I love this movie. I don't know what was wrong with me the first time I watched it.
You hadn't fallen for the siren spell of Nero Nun Point whatever In the Air Tonight.
Yeah, I don't even care about that song. Just that scene. I love that scene. That's one of the scenes where you really understand what a tight crew they are and what how deep their partnership goes, because they're all about the action. Just like Marshawn Lynch. They're all about the action. And so that they don't talk. They're just in the car. They're all business. You know as a viewer how tense it is and how stressful a situation it is that they're in. So you know how much they're sweating the outcome of what they're about to do. And they're just going. They're preparing, they're not talking. You know, Tubbs is in the passenger seat loading his shotgun, which is a direct takeoff of the similar scene in the television show, which I loved. And it, again, this was just a scene that was all about mood, setting up the next scene, just putting you in the mood. It was quiet, but it was tense. And it was definitely the calm before the storm that you knew was coming.
Oh, that's true. Was there a Gina equivalent in the TV show?
No.
Okay, that's a shame. Because I really liked the Gina character.
She was badass.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah.
I didn't even realize that was the woman from Orange is the New Black.
Well, I didn't, you know, at first I wasn't even sure she was the team member in the beginning of the whole thing. But yeah, no, it's, yeah, she gets some quality screen time. So, yeah.
She's great.
Okay, so the tension is ratcheted up. And we have this, you know, this is where we switch from the big film camera to the smaller digital cameras with lots of zooming in and close-ups and stuff. And you've got, it's kind of I think it's a Michael Mann thing, but a lot of his interiors aren't, they're just like stark white interiors of like apartments and houses. Not a lot of knickknacks in Michael Mann's interior scenes.
Yeah, that's a great observation, because I'm just going through my mental catalog. Yeah, like all of his interiors are really minimalistic.
Yeah, they're kind of, and I wish it was my original observation, but I'm sure I read it in some sort of review. But yeah, it was a lot like Rust Cole's apartment. Like that's a real Michael Mann kind of interior shot.
For sure.
So, and it even carries on to the trailer,
That's a great reference, by the way, because you know Colin Farrell's in season 2 of True Detective.
Yeah, yeah. It'll be interesting to see what they do. After seeing season 1, I'm almost afraid that they're even going to do season 2. But I realize that they can't take season 1 away from me, so that's fine.
It's true. No, I agree. I wouldn't have been mad if there was no season 2.
Yeah, yeah. Or they called it something else, or whatever. Nick Palazzo's new crime thing. I don't know. We'll see. I trust them, though. I'll definitely go back, because it was a fun ride. Oh, by the way, I don't dislike Colin Farrell. I actually thought Colin Farrell was the best part, one of the only good parts, of the remake of Fright Night. I thought he pulled it off just fine.
that's your Colin Farrell reference?
Well, okay. I don't know. I'm trying to think. Did I even see Alexander? I don't think I did.
I thought that was pretty terrible. I mean, he was fine. He was in a movie about the Vietnam War called Tigerland that he was really good in.
Well, he's supposed to be good in In Bruges. We'll find out for next week.
You haven't seen In Bruges?
Nope.
Oh, I love that movie.
Yep, lots of people do, so I'm looking forward to it. So the reason I bring up the stark interiors is even in the exterior of the trailer park at night, because as I said before, it's all this movie takes place pretty much at night, at least when they're outside, is the white trailer and like the white or reflected off of the streetlights, the white kind of gravel road, and then everybody wearing, you know, dark vests and stuff. So it's very stark. And then inside the trailer, it's the same thing. It's almost like a black and white movie. And that lends itself to what, you know, these tight close-up action scenes. And I thought they did a really good job with the actual raid on the trailer. And this is where Jamie Foxx gets to be the cold-blooded like killer that you know he's supposed to be. Or maybe not killer is a strong word, but they pretty much, they're not playing around. They don't pull punches. They're there for one objective, and they're going to rescue their friend. And they don't care if they have to shoot people in the back of the head, which turns out an investigation later would probably have a problem with the cop shooting the bad guys in the back of the head as they're on the ground. But second guessing, you know, not great. And they'll slap a kid around, too.
Whatever you got to do.
Yeah, yeah. Well, like I said, and this is, you know, it's where Elizabeth Rodriguez gets to shine. And everything's great. They rescue the girl. Everything's fine. Except that...
They rescue the girl because what's her name? Calabrese takes a badass shot.
Oh, completely. Yeah, she takes a sniper shot pretty much from close range. Even though the guy's got some sort of trigger mechanism for the bomb around the neck, she hits him in the brainstem, and he just goes down.
Yeah, that, after giving a nice little tough guy speech that she gives him about telling him what she's going to do, and then she does it.
Yes. Oh, yeah. She's a total badass.
I love the fact that she was the hero of this scene.
Yeah. Yep. Yeah, because you're right. Because in a lesser movie, Tubbs would have been the hero, or even Crockett. But Crockett spends most of the time outside, right?
Right. Yeah. He's making sure nobody sneaks up on him.
Yeah. Well, and that's the part of the scene that I didn't quite get, because there was no established threat from the outside, was there? I mean, except that one guard. They look like they expected a big bunch of retaliation to come from what, other trailers or something?
Yeah, well, I think they went in so quickly without much recon. They just didn't know.
So
that's how I read it.
Yeah, well, and like I said, it works out fine because it's such a great scene that they come outside and they're going to have to extract her outside too. But they unfortunately leave her in the trailer, or in the door of the trailer, for just a little too long, because when Euro finds out that the raid has happened, he detonates the bomb remotely.
Well, he doesn't find out that the raid happened. He finds out that they never made the drop. So the guys on the boat were kind of lollygagging to give Crockett and Tubbs time to raid the trailer, because they knew as soon as the guys on the boat made the drop, they'd kill Trudy. So Euro got the call that they never showed up, and they blew the timetable. So he didn't necessarily know that the raid on the trailer had happened, but he knew something was wrong.
So he was just going to blow up everybody in the trailer?
Yeah, he had a backup plan.
Yeah, I guess. Well, that's why he's one of the bosses. Contingencies and logistics. It's all about contingencies and logistics. Unfortunately, yeah, because he detonates the bomb remotely, Trudy is seriously injured. and they have to get her to the hospital, and they commandeer a police car. And I was wondering, okay, what officer is just going to let them take his police car? I mean, granted, you know, it's all the department's stuff, but like, what, is he going to walk home? I mean, officers end up with each other's cuffs all the time because that's just how things work out. And so you end up with your cuffs back in your mailbox or whatever when you're, you know, next time you go there. That's why you have extra cuffs. You don't have an extra car.
That's maybe some inside baseball for police work.
I guess. I would have
never thought about that because they're just moving forward.
Yeah.
When that happens, when they see Trudy, they don't even talk about it. They just go. Because they're that tight of a team. They just go.
Well, and we've already had a scene that I skipped past where you have, after Crockett and Isabella have their deep love connection in Cuba, she is like getting ready to go to bed with Montoya, and she reveals that she slept with Crockett, and Montoya's like, "You okay?" And well, Euro finds out that she and Crockett have this thing going on because they end up meeting in Euro's nightclub, and there's some slow dancing between Crockett and Isabella, which is a little ridiculous, but I'll give it to him. It's fine. It's Miami, right? So he ends up showing Montoya the tape, saying, you know, this is no little dalliance. This is a betrayal. An awful, awful betrayal.
He has this awesome, sort of pseudo Tony Montoya accent, especially when he's talking to Montoya. And he's like, "This is not casual."
Yeah, well, that's true. I didn't realize it at the time, but yeah, that makes a lot of sense. Well, there is, you know, that's the thing about this movie, is that they're trying to capture that Miami feeling. And I'm not sure that they did, but partly it's because things were moving so quickly, I think, that, you know, I mean, I think Dexter captured the Miami feeling better, even just in the first episode.
Well, yeah, and this was like the scuzzy part of Miami. This wasn't even like the same Miami from the television show.
Oh,
like
yeah, you're
right. The nightclubs were kind of scuzzy. All of the criminal business that happens is done in like really like scuzzy docks and abandoned neighborhoods.
Yeah, and then there's the scenes in, you know, Cuba and Haiti and places like that. So it's, you know, anyway. So we're all setting up for what we knew was coming from the beginning, where there's going to be a big showdown between Crockett and Tubbs and Euro and his guys and the Aryan Brotherhood. And they're all going to go to the port of Miami to have this big old showdown.
Yeah. Crockett gets a call while he's like organizing his trunk at the hospital, and finds out that their cover's not blown. Euro doesn't like them, but he doesn't know they're cops. So, and they still have the product from the shipment that they never delivered. So Euro wants that back, and Crockett makes a deal to give it back to him for the cash that he would have been owed later, but only if Euro's there. So it's their one last chance to actually nab Euro. So they make a plan to do an exchange, knowing full well that the Aryan Brotherhood is going to have their snipers kill them once they exchange the product.
Oh yeah, and it's established they have what, those 50 caliber sniper rifles or whatever. So
yeah.
So their body armor is not necessarily going to be all that effective. And
it might have even been the exact same location as that first FBI deal that went bad.
Oh, could have been. Absolutely, yeah. And that Castillo says, you know, you are not to make any moves before we find out exactly where their snipers are and take them out. So it's all very tactical, kind of. But we find out that, of course, Yuro brings along a hostage, kind of, and that's Isabella. And so during the face-off, where one party is going to verify the money and the other verifies the drugs, they basically trade Isabella for Herc. Like, were they just sending Herc to his death?
No, Herc was just going to go verify that they had the money.
Yeah, well, when the shooting starts, Herc is on the wrong side. It seems like fraught with peril for Herc.
They're all badasses. He could take care of himself, and he did.
And he did, yes, exactly. So, luckily. So we have the final scene where the Miami guys take out the snipers, and then a full-on gunfight happens. And, everybody dies good. During the firefight, we have Mr. Aniston get shot and has to tourniquet his own leg.
And then shoot while rolling around because he can't walk.
Yes. And the Aryan Brotherhood guy gets killed nicely, and Yuro dies really good. Yet, this is, when it all comes down to it, this is a love story. So when Crockett starts calling in backup, he has already put Isabella at a fairly safe place, and they're separated.
Well, she is freaking the fuck out because she just now realizes that her boyfriend is a cop.
Exactly. Yeah, she sees his badge, and she's like, "Oh, this is not good."
She is not happy. She does not like cops, it turns out.
No. She's not very happy at all. And
even though he just rescued her from psychopath Crazy Eyes, she is still deeply pissed.
Well, and she is not, all is not sunshine and light in her life at this point, because, you know, now she's with the cops, and that's not a safe place to be when her life has been in the upper echelon of the criminal enterprise. Because Brody's older brother is going to come after her, presumably. So there's a nice little tent scene, and he ends up taking her to the safe house, and he has a tearful goodbye when he sends her to her home in Cuba. And at the same time, Tubbs is at the hospital, keeping an eye on Trudy. So it's all a love story. Except in this case, it's love lost because Crockett can't follow her to Cuba either. So it's a very tearful kind of ending.
No way. He's going to find her, right?
Oh, I wasn't sure whether he was crying because of the love, or he was crying because he had ate too much of his own homemade donkey sauce that he dips his wings into.
the way I read it was he saved her and got her out because he loved her, but he also recognized that he betrayed her trust. So they had a conversation earlier in the movie where he talked about her getting out and just disappearing, and then him finding her so they could live out their lives together. So I think that moment was him knowing that even if he did find her later, didn't know if she would accept him because he had betrayed her by being a cop.
Well, and there's a callback to a line in Heat in this movie at this point.
Time is luck.
Yes, because that's exactly what they say during the De Niro Pacino conversation, or am I missing what part of Heat that's from?
I thought that was when he was talking with Edie.
Oh, it might be, yeah.
You know what? Yeah. Done. I need to watch Heat again. I'm into it.
Oh yeah, no, I'm gonna have to watch Heat again.
But... I'll get to the bottom of this.
Okay, yeah, you do that. Okay, so at the end, so you thought it was a successful ending.
I did. I like the fact that there was some sort of government raid on Montoya's house in Colombia, and it was empty. He was gone. He was in the wind.
Oh yeah, yeah. No. Montoya survives for Miami Vice Dos, or whatever. Except, turns out there's not going to be a Miami Vice Dos at least anytime soon. Because do you know how much this movie cost to make?
No.
I'll tell you, $150 million. Do you know what the worldwide gross of this movie was? I'll tell you.
No.
$64 million. So, not so good.
That's too bad. Although, you know, when I walked out of this movie in the theater, I truly was like, the fuck did I just watch? That was terrible.
Well, I actually, after watching this movie, I Googled the phrase Michael Mann's biggest bomb. And you know what I got? I got several pages of the same thing. You want to take a guess? I mean, you'll
the Black Hat.
Yes.
Yeah. Then I think that movie made single digit millions, right?
Oh, I don't know, but yeah, apparently it's not great, or at least it's not been received well. And there's somebody from this movie that's in Black Hat. Who's in Black Hat from this movie?
I have no idea.
Ah, I didn't write it down. Oh well. Yeah. So I mean, I still trust Michael Mann. But I don't know. I thought this was just not up to snuff. I thought it was too slow. Maybe because I had TV show in my head, I just thought that this could have been a two-part TV show, which still would not have been 2 hours and, what, 15 minutes?
Yeah. So you don't remember the TV show, right?
No, nope, not at all.
We established that.
We established that.
Let me describe to you the two-part pilot episode of Miami Vice.
Please do.
The pilot really, as it should, set the tone for what kind of show it was. And it shocked me when I first watched it, because here's the premise. A New York cop is, undercover cop is gunned down during a drug deal. His brother, who's also a cop, steals his identity, and fakes, a letter of cooperation to track this drug dealer down to Miami, where he ends up teaming up with a Miami Vice detective. And, so there's some sort of mismatch partner antics that go along with that. Then there's some slapsticky parts to it. But while they're tracking down this drug kingpin, who they've both been chasing, our introduction to Crockett is when his current partner gets blown up in a drug deal gone bad, which is why he is available to partner with this imposter Tubbs. And eventually they work it out. Crockett finds out who he really is and the fact that he's there for nefarious reasons, and they. During the whole thing, there's also a leak. They're trying to figure out who the leak in the department is, who's feeding information to this drug kingpin. And it turns out it's Crockett's old partner, who he arrests while he's having dinner with his family. And after that really kind of devastating scene leads right into the In There Tonight scene, where Crockett and Tubbs are going to the final deal to get the kingpin Calderon. And of course it ends with a shootout. And in the shootout, Tubbs has Calderon in his sights, doesn't pull the trigger because it's a mid-80s network television show. And they arrest him. And within minutes in the timeline of the show, they go to pick him up at the jail and transport him to a more secure facility. And Calderon has already been let out by a corrupt judge on $2 million bail, which I'm sure was even more of a huge amount back in the mid 80s. And they find out they're just minutes behind him. So they know he's going to run, and they try and catch him, but they don't get to him in time. They get to him in time, just in time enough to see him getting on his plane and flying away. And he gets away. And that's how the first episode of Miami Vice ends.
So does Calderon then stay the bad guy through most of the series?
I think he comes back later on in season one and they get him. But that's the kind of dark ending that the show starts on.
Well, that's good, though. I mean, it makes it compelling.
Yeah.
Because otherwise you'd think that everything was going to wrap up, because this was pretty much, well, no, I was going to say it's, there were already shows that were doing like the long story arcs, but this was in the beginning of that when it became much more pronounced.
Yeah. So when I saw this movie the first time, that is not the show I thought it was.
You were thinking more of Nash Bridges kind of thing?
Probably, yeah. I think that's probably a better comparison. So, and it's funny, after I watched the movie again for this, for our discussion, I shared with my wife that I was surprised because I really, really enjoyed it this time. And she reminded me that she told me when we watched it in the theater together that she actually quite liked it and was, thought it was silly that I didn't. And I'm trying to remember. I may have just blown her off because she likes Colin Farrell. So, but yeah, she remembered really liking the movie in the theater. So she thought it has taken me too long to come around to it.
How does she feel about Guy Fieri?
I think if you were to ask her, she would shrug her shoulders.
We'll have to ask her next time I see her.
So I thought this movie, I really, really love this movie this time around. I mean, it's, I think I settle into it really easily now because this movie and Collateral and Heat all kind of feel like they're in the same universe. So it's a comfortable place for me. I have a lot of trust being in that universe. So I'm sure I'm really willing to go along for the ride.
Well, but, I trust everybody in this movie, but Colin Farrell, I don't trust him. He just seems fake from the beginning. He doesn't belong.
His accent was really unfortunate.
But also his looks. It may be the combination of his hair and his eyebrows and his mustache. But like when he gets the sad face, he goes from like the squinty serious look to the like sad hound dog look in a really dramatic way. I mean, it's like somebody pulling strings on like a Muppet.
Yeah. I mean, I don't know what style choices led them to his look, but it really is if they decided they were going to take John Boyd from Heat and wipe off his freckles and pull his hairline forward and shorten his cuffs.
Because they didn't, I mean, the linen suits and stuff, that was all Crockett from the TV show. But I didn't think, well, I didn't think, first of all, that Tubbs from the movie had anything to do with the Tubbs character from the TV show, not even knowing the part about the whole, the imposter angle, you know, knowing nothing about that. I didn't see any connection at all. I just thought it was, you know, it would be in a fine buddy cop movie, and they didn't even need to be called Crockett and Tubbs.
No, they didn't. I mean, because it's not Crockett from the TV show either. I mean, the Don Johnson version was he really was like a by-the-book cop. He was a straight man to the wild card that was Tubbs. And he was also a divorcee who had a son. So he struggled with, you know, trying to be a father at the same time, which is not at all this Crockett.
Oh, no. And he was also like something of a ladies' man too, right?
Right. Yeah, he tried to charm a bartender very early in the movie.
Yeah. So, but I mean, I think that's just, you know, that's kind of what he provided anyway, and there wasn't time to establish all those things, which I get. I understand that if you only have 2 hours and 20 minutes to work with, or maybe 97 minutes would have been better, that, you know, you have to make choices. And that's fine. Plopping you in the middle of a story is fine. It's just that I thought that the scene where Tubbs and Trudy talk and the scene where Crockett and Isabella go to Cuba just drug down the whole pace of the movie.
Yeah, I think I was there with you back in 2006.
So I'm going to have to wait 9 years and try again?
I really want to see Black Hat now.
Well, the previews look good. I don't, you know. Someday I'll see a movie in the theater again that doesn't involve animation. Did I tell you we saw SpongeBob SquarePants, Sponge Out of Water on opening day?
No, how was it?
It was, first of all, if you've seen the previews and it's all like 3D superhero sort of stuff, that's the last 15 minutes of it. And the first hour of it is, or hour 15 or whatever, is just 2D animation, which has clever parts to it. I mean, don't get me wrong. It was plenty enjoyable, but it was an 11-minute cartoon, or a series of 11-minute cartoons strung into a movie, which, like I said, it was fine. The theater was empty enough that Kelly dimmed her phone and read a book on her phone. And Journey and I watched the movie, which was just fine. And three of us, it was like $50, slightly over $50. So,
was it a 3D movie?
No, we didn't see the 3D version. Nope. I mean, granted,
wow, $50.
Well, it was $18 for the three of us to get in, and then it was $34 to get a couple of sodas. I mean, we got concessions. I think Kelly got nachos, Oh, and yeah, Journey got some Otis Spunkmeyer cookies.
Excellent.
Yeah. So, anyway, to me, this is not a recommend, but for you, it's a recommend, and that's good that we at least disagree enough to have a rousing conversation.
Indeed. By the way, John Ortiz was in Black Hat.
Oh, okay, cool. Well, see there, right there, that recommends it to me.
I also recommend John Goes Boating.
Okay. Excellent. I think we can both recommend Collateral.
Mm-hmm. Oh, and Curse of the Golden Flower. You got to check that one out.
Okay, Curse of the Golden Flower. Send your feedback to show@notinthecreepyway.com or call us on our new voicemail account to leave voice messages. Or you can text us at this account to leave text messages. The number is 425-243-9169. That's 425-243-9169. What are you waiting for? Put it in your phone right now, and then when you listen to an episode, you can just hit your contacts, dial it already.